Welcome to the Original Gangsters, members only Patreon. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. We're going to do one of my favorites, as I keep on saying, as I keep on rolling out these type of episodes. It's going to be a hybrid. I'm going to title this a true crime tale, but in reality, it's kind of a true crime tale and a Scott Bernstein Hollywood tale. Composite episode, if you will. So I'm going out of the OC box or traditional OC box right now. We're not going to talk LCN or bikers or drug kingpins. We're going to talk Charles Manson and the Manson family back in California in the 1960s and 70s. I have some opinions about Manson and the whole phenomena of the Manson family and what kind of perception versus reality and separating fact from fiction. And we'll get into that. But I also want to talk about a television show that I had in development that I thought was going to be really cool. And never, died on the vine, but it had to do with Charles Manson and the Manson family's unsolved murders, the cold case murders. Everybody knows about the Sharon Tate massacre and the LaBianca murders the night following the Tate Polanski slayings. And, those were seven murders that, still get headlines and embedded in the so much of pop culture fabric, the counterculture, hippies gone wild. The story's been told over and over and over again. So I'm always looking for, new angles into old stories. And let me first say that when people ask me where my interest or fascination in crime comes from, or reporting on true crime, like when did I start paying attention or reading about it or researching about it, writing about it? And, in terms of traditional organized crime, I didn't start until I was in my mid to late 20s and wrote some books and worked at newspapers and did it the traditional way. But I wasn't interested in that stuff growing up. I was around it because of some of my family members in Detroit. I was surrounded by a lot of the Detroit La Cosa Nostra, the Jewish wing of that. I was around it a lot, but I didn't really know what it was. I didn't understand it. I didn't really care. It was just, my grandfather and his friends and my grandpa's bloodline, which dated back to Prohibition and the Purple Gang. And it just it wasn't anything that I was really that interested in, other than having some conversations at dinner tables and meeting some of my grandpa's colorful friends, who I just thought were colorful old Jewish guys. And I found out later that they all had FBI jackets and some were suspected murderers. But I digress. At the time, I didn't really care about it. What really sparked my interest in true crime was two things: the Manson case and the JFK, and I guess MLK assassinations. None of this stuff I was alive for, but starting, I would say late elementary school, early junior high school, when I was being asked to do assignments or research papers, or the equivalent of whatever a research paper would be for an 11 or 12 year old, I dove into the assassinations of JFK and MLK. And then when I was 13, maybe, in finishing up junior high, I took a biopsychology class. I might have been in ninth grade. It was either in eighth grade or not. I think it was in eighth grade. Biopsychology class. And I was assigned the Manson case to do a big you know, for a 13-year-old doing a 10-page paper or whatever, I think it was 10, 12-page paper, was an undertaking. And I got the bug. And from that point forward, I had always, and I still have, I still do, follow very closely the history, the legacy, and the initial true crime tale of Charles Manson and that very bloody summer of 69. And I thought it'd be cool to try to do a TV project about it. And in 2019 or 18 or 19, I'd been in the business at that point for 4 or 5 years. I was coming off of the White Boy Rick film and documentary. I'd done a lot of stuff on the History Channel and Discovery and the Bio Channel. And I teamed with a guy named Paul Epstein, who's a producer and showrunner, who was at the History Channel and then was at Peacock. This was at the same time I was working on a Hoffa show with Paul, and he had asked me about other projects that we could maybe develop together. And I brought him these unsolved Manson murders to align with the 50th anniversary of the case. And within the nine that I've been able to pinpoint murders that the Manson family carried out between 1968 and around 1975, 76, that have never been solved. And that they most likely were the killers. So one of these murders is a absolutely fascinating truth is stranger than fiction type scenario that no one really knows about, that I got from a group of ex-law enforcement. There had actually been a task force in the late 90s, early 2000s, set up by LAPD and the FBI in Southern California to investigate cold case Manson murders. Didn't result in any charges, but I think they were able to shake some trees and get some information. And those investigators, because of other things that they were involved in, I became friendly with some of them, and they tipped me off to this unsolved Manson murder that actually took place in Nevada. And I'll get into the whole story. It involved a murder and a treasure map and buried gold. It was like an old Western or an episode of The Lone Ranger or Bonanza. I don't know. It was a crazy story that has never really been told, nor, you know, solved. And I really wanted to get it out in a television show form, using that as kind of the lens into the rest of the cold case murders. It died on the vine. We were developing it along with the Hoffa project that never made it to air either. And you got to understand, I hope people that are watching this and have seen me and I've said this, I'll keep saying it. There are 1,000 times the amount of projects that are in some sort of development at various networks and production houses that just never see the light of day. That they development money goes into them, and for whatever reason, and there's a million different reasons why something doesn't make it to air, but it doesn't make it to air. So I've had a half dozen things make it to air in terms of stuff that I've produced or been involved in. And that's not counting the stuff I do, you know, talking head work on for, where you see me on the History Channel or other networks where you see me as a what people call a talking head in, you know, biography episodes or history's greatest mysteries, America's most evil gangster, stuff like that. But I've had about a half dozen things make it either to a movie theater or a streamer or a television network. But I've had another, if there's been a half dozen that have made it, there's been another three dozen that I've worked on that haven't. So this was one of them. And I think I talked about it in some of my past Hollywood tales. I know I talked about Hoffa and some of the stuff that I'd been developing with Hoffa. And one of the projects there, I spoke about being with the Peacock people. And back then, Peacock was either hadn't launched yet or was about to launch. And this was another project that was with them. And they were trying to line up content for the 50th anniversary of the Manson case, which was in 2019, August 1969 to August of 2019. And again, nothing ever got made, but I'm going to tell everyone, I'm going to break down for everyone this unsolved murder and journey looking for buried treasure and cryptic scrawlings in abandoned courthouses. There is a lot of intrigue and mystique that surrounds this very, very, very little known Manson slaying. And so first, before I jump into it, I just want to give my initial, or not initial, my after all the years that I've studied the case, and I haven't really written a lot about the case. I put together a very comprehensive Manson family timeline that was actually purchased by Netflix to use in one of their docuseries. But that's the only really piece of content that I've ever really sold professionally and related to Manson or reporting I've done with Manson. So, you know, everybody knows me as the mob reporting guy or the white boy Rick guy or the Hoffa guy or the Black Mafia family guy, the Hell's Angel guy, the Outlaws, Pagans guy. But the Manson case is still riveting to me all these years later. So I want to, before I get into this murder mystery search for missing gold case, I want to tell everyone that I think Manson as an entity or as a pop culture deity or a counterculture figure or as a criminal, I don't want to say overrated. He was overrated in terms of how dangerous he was. He wanted to be the face of evil, and he really got off on giving people the death stares and the, you know, trying to basically kill somebody with a stare. And there were a lot of pictures that made their way into newspapers and magazines, and where he looks like evil incarnate, and he loves it. And that reinforced this notion that Charles Manson was the ultimate evildoer or miscreant. And I'm here to tell you know, Charles Manson was a lot of things, and he did a lot of things very well. And in some ways, Charles Manson was more of a hippie mob boss than he was some, you know, crazy serial killer that he, you know, he gets lumped into to the, you know, the serial killer vibe or the mass murder vibe more so than, you know, the organized crime, you know, the stuff where people talk about Gotti or Capone or, and I'm not saying he was a Gotti or Capone, but he was running rackets more than he was really running a cult. That cult was a mini crime family. They were a criminal enterprise where they were prostituting, they were robbing houses, they were operating in the stolen goods industry in Southern California. They were working with bikers. They were selling drugs. There was a lot of they're operating a chop shop. There was a lot of different spaces of criminality that were being filled by Manson and his family. And he had these women or these young ladies and these drugged out hippie guys doing crime for him more so than sitting there. You know, yeah, they were doing drugs and having sex and listening to the Manson go on about how he was Jesus Christ, but they were more of a crime family than a cult. So and Manson is a pussy, for lack of a better word. I mean, Manson, if he was such a badass, he would have gone and killed all those people himself. Instead, he, you know, brainwashed a bunch of women to go stab Sharon, you know, a pregnant Sharon Tate 57 times. If Manson was so evil, if he was so dangerous, you know, he would have gone and done it himself. So I think, you know, Manson is overrated in that regards, but he's a little bit, I would say, misunderstood and maybe underrated in what he was actually doing and how close he was to breaking into mainstream music. I mean, the Beach Boys recorded music of his. Brian Wilson almost Dennis Wilson, pretty much became a member of the family for a year. Neil Young was another person that socialized and tried to get Manson a record deal. So a lot of what he did had nothing really to do with wanting to start a race war or attack the establishment, other than him attacking the establishment in that he lashed out because he was rejected by the music industry, rejected by Hollywood. It really had nothing to do with him. It was jealousy and envy. It wasn't a true issue of the haves and the have-nots, or trying to take over the world or think you're Jesus Christ. That was all window dressing. He wanted to be famous, and the only way he could become famous after getting thrown out of the music industry because he was too weird and he freaked people out was that he could kill a bunch of people or have a bunch of people killed. So that's my – and he knew if he did it in Beverly Hills that it was going to get the kind of attention that it got. But let's get into – the case that I'm talking about, which it took me 20 minutes to do this, but I'm glad everybody stayed with me. This is that we don't have an exact name on this particular victim. He went by the Old Prospector. That's how everybody knew him in town. And when I say town, I mean Belmont, Nevada. And I'm going to tell you how the Manson family got to Belmont, Nevada in a moment. This was in late 1968, early 1969. So this was about 8 months, nine months before the Manson murders. And this was when they were jumping from different campsites, going from the Barker Ranch to the Spawn Ranch. And this was, I think, in between Barker and Spawn. They went into Nevada as a group. I think there was a couple dozen of them that crossed over. And it wasn't a long trip from where they were in the hills of Simi Valley. And there was a Manson family member, Sherry Cooper, who went by the nickname Simi Valley Sherry, and she knew the hills very well. She had grown up in this Belmont, Nevada, which is right by the border, the California border. And she had known about this, I want to say notorious, somebody that was known in the small town of Belmont, Nevada, back in the 50s and 60s, he was a kind of a recluse who lived in the woods and told everybody that he had $1 million of gold buried somewhere, and that he was, you know, saving it or sitting on it, or it was this, it almost became like an old wives' tale that made its way around town all for, you know, for decades. But from talking to some of the people that actually investigated this cold case murder, they believe that there is an actual stash of gold somewhere right now in the 2020s, or at the time I was pitching this in 2019, but that what the Manson family went in search of in Belmont, Nevada, because of this tip off from Sherry Cooper, it was real. That there was a stash of gold somewhere, and there still is. So I guess Sherry Cooper tells Manson that in her hometown of Belmont, there's this crazy guy that says he has gold. Let's go see if he really does have gold. And they make their way as a group, hitchhiking, or I don't know exactly how, to Belmont, Nevada, and they take refuge in a abandoned courthouse in the town square, and they stayed there for a couple weeks. And we know that they were there because of city law enforcement records that show that they got ejected. I think they got there in I'm looking at it right now. They got there in February. No, sorry. Yeah, late February of 69, and they were thrown out of there in early March of 69. Eventually made their way to Spawn Ranch, where they were when they killed Sharon Tate and all the people at her house. So while they were there, they were, you know, graffiti in the place. Or carving stuff in the walls. And at the time, I guess it was considered like an historic marker because it had been a courthouse where they like hung people back in the, you know, the Wild West. So they got some tickets. They didn't have to do any jail time, but they were ticketed for vagrancy and vagrancy. And I guess larceny, I guess they might have stole something, and vandalism. So we know they were there. There was a guy that, again, everybody called him the old prospector. Some people think his name was Clifford Adams, but this had not been confirmed. But Clifford Adams was the name that they were going on as a potential government name for him. And in the 48 hours before they were evicted and kicked out of town, there is records from the local hospital, which is called Grant Hospital, about a man who, in the records that I've seen, it's redacted what his name was. Some of these investigators told me it was Clifford Adams, and that's what they were going on. It might be, you know, under the redaction, it might say Clifford Adams in there, but he died at Grant Hospital from being beaten to death. And his last words were, "They never got it out of me. I never told them where the gold was. Those damn hippies wouldn't stop punching and kicking me. They thought I would give it up, but I never did." And those were his last words. And the hippies were identified in these in this 20 years ago, 25 years ago, in this investigation by LAPD and the LA FBI, that the hippies that he was referring to were the Manson family, and that they had been taken to his residence by Sherry Cooper. Within this investigation, that took place 20, 25 years ago, they found a treasure map. And there is a map that I guess takes you to this gold that some of the now retired members of that task force have in their possession. And that was part of the pitch with the History Channel and Peacock, was that we were going to get these retired FBI agents and we were to not just tell you the story of all these cold case Manson murders and drill down on this one particular old prospector's murder, but we were going to actually go look for gold and maybe we could find it. That was, to me, it seemed like such a great idea. I fell in love with the idea, even if we wouldn't have found gold. The idea that that would be the kind of the premise of the show in real time, while, you know, backtracking, you know, into the 60s and 70s, telling all the old stories through archival video and interviews with people. But then in real time, while we were shooting the show, you'd be seeing us look for gold. I've told you guys in some of these episodes where I talk about these projects I work on, you know, why they, you know, or what I'm told, at least, why they never got past development and into a production. And with this, I was told that they were worried that they wouldn't find the gold and that they wouldn't want to air the show if the whole show was about finding gold and you didn't find it. I understand that, but I think you could spin it or frame it in a way where it's like, well, the search never ends. Even if you didn't find it at the end of that episode or at the end of the show or the end of the docuseries, you know, you could use that as a way to get a season two and a season three. So, you know, that's what we were told, and we never got it into production, but it was cool. We developed it for less than a year. It was probably 6 months, 8 months. A lot of times those deals run like, you know, they're like 18-month deals or 12-month deals. But even if it's a 12-month or 18-month deal, a development deal, sometimes you only work on it for, you know, a portion of that time. You're still getting paid for that time, but sometimes the, you know, you get put on the shelf by whoever has the deal with you. And even though you got 18 months, they're done with you out of eight, but you got to sit there for 10 months and wait for it to, you know, expire, because you can't go and then take that idea somewhere else because they have the rights to it. But I still think that this is something that, you know, in the future, I would love to try to get a show off the ground based on Manson cold case murders and this Belmont, Nevada search for gold. One of the guys that I communicate with that was on that task force is adamant that the gold is there. It's just a matter of having the resources to go find it. So, you know, it's in some ways it's similar to some of the Hoffa stuff where, you know, you can know where someone is in theory. I'm not saying people know where Jimmy Hoffa is, but, you know how much money it takes to excavate something and all the red tape you have to go through to get permission to excavate properties or whatnot. And it's the same thing if this gold was underground. So there were a lot of hoops to jump through to get to the point where you could go find it and have the financial backing to go do it. And it's not on your dime. So we'll see. But I thought that was a fun project to recall and a really interesting story, because I do think that the Manson family killed this guy. They thought that they needed, well, Manson was convincing them that they needed money for some trek into the desert after civilization fell apart in the race war that he was predicting. And, you know, they needed, you know, money to hide out and let everyone kill each other, and then they would emerge from the underground as kings of the world. I mean, that was what Manson, that was what the Helter Skelter, you know, conspiracy or methodology or theology or whatever espoused. So I think that nobody knows that there were other murders. And those murders took place for various reasons. I'll go through just before, as we wrap up. I got some of the development documents in front of me right now. So I guess there were 10. I said 9 murders, but I guess there were 10 because one they considered solved. But there were 10 original cold case murders. One, I guess, was solved in 16. When they say solved, I don't know. I don't think that means that they brought anyone. I don't think that means that they brought anyone to justice, but I think it means that they know who did it and those people are dead and they can't bring those people to justice. So 10 overall cold case murders, one of which has been theoretically solved. So I guess 9 that still need closure. And, I guess maybe 8. There's another one that I'm seeing. I guess it's still on the list. It's one of the 9, but I guess this one is the one they consider possible that it didn't have anything to do with the Manson family, even though the Manson family were suspects. So I'm going to run these down. And I would just love to tell this untold part of the Manson story, because as I said at the beginning of this, I mean, how many times have you seen documentaries and TV shows and movies about Manson? I mean, it's ubiquitous, especially when you're talking about the late 60s counterculture narrative. You can't tell the story of the end of the 60s without talking about Manson. And Manson and Woodstock, they both happen in the same 3 or 4 days, which is interesting. People don't think about that. At the same time Woodstock was going on, it was the same time Manson was killing all these people, and just on opposite sides of the country. So, all right, October 1968, Nancy Warren and Cleta Delaney. Nancy was pregnant. Cleta was her grandmother. They were both strangled to death in Ukiah, California. Manson family are considered suspects in that. December 27, 1968, Marina Habe, who was a member of the family, was found strangled to death off Mulholland Drive. Then we have the Old Prospector murder in March of 1969. Then we get into the summer of 1969 was when all the insanity really started to ramp up. July 17, 69. Mark Watts, who was also a member of the family, was found shot to death in a ditch off of Mulholland Drive. Now we're going to be into the time period after the Tate-LaBianca murders, November 7th, 1969. Tate-LaBianca happened August 8th through the 10th of 69. November 7th, 69, Jimmy Sharp and Doreen Gall, they were a teenage couple that had spent a lot of time on Spawn Ranch with the Mansons, and they were found stabbed to death in the same neighborhood that the LaBiancas were killed in. The LaBiancas were the house that they targeted on the second night of that rampage in August. November of 69, this is the one that I guess was solved in 16. Reet Jurvetson, who was a member of the family, a teenager, and she was found stabbed to death in a ditch off Mulholland Drive. Seemed to be a female. December 1st, 69, a guy named Joel Pugh, whose wife was a member of the family, is stabbed to death in London. Some of the Manson members had fled the country during the initial arrests of people for the Tate-LaBianca and landed in London. One of the main Manson people, Bruce Davis, I know is considered a suspect in that murder. And then November 28, 1970, during the trial, one of the defense attorneys, Ron Hughes, disappeared mid-trial. That's the one I think the cold case squad 20 years ago, or 10, let's say, in, you know, this says the cold case was still active in 16. So after some of the guys that I know got off that Cold Case Squad. But I know that the Ron Hughes one, which was the, he was a defense attorney defending Manson and his family. And they were fighting over defense tactics in on a break from trial over a weekend. I think it was a long weekend. It might've been, what I'm looking at this. This was, this was Thanksgiving week. So it was a recess over Thanksgiving, and Ron Hughes disappeared. They've never found him. And I know that was kind of like the, in their mind, was going to be the crown jewel. If they could have solved these cold case murders, they wanted the Hughes one to be out in front. And then finally, in January of 77, a film director by the name of Lawrence Merrick was killed outside his Hollywood office. Merrick had filmed the documentary on the Manson family while the trial was going on, and had had a falling out over the edits of that documentary. This is the one that authorities believe that there's a good chance this was not Manson and his followers. I mean, Manson was locked up at that point, but it wasn't Manson's followers that this had to do with another issue that Merrick had with somebody else in the film industry. It's never been solved, but I guess Manson family still considered suspects, but this is the one on the list that is considered least likely to be connected to Manson. But so that's what we got. Hopefully one day you'll see me on the History Channel with some retired FBI agents, digging for gold in Belmont, Nevada. Hope everybody's enjoying all the fresh content we got. Please like, share, and subscribe. Original Gangsters here on Patreon, out on YouTube, on Original Gangsters News Network, our companion web magazine, The Gangster Report. I appreciate everybody and their support. Love giving you guys all this great true crime knowledge. I hope you guys love receiving it as much as I love dishing it out. Scott Bernstein, Original Gangsters, members only, Patreon. I'm out.